Aaron was informed that his baby brother had been chosen to become the most influential Israelite in the history of the people, and he responded with nothing but joy, with a fullness of heart, and without the slightest trace of envy. It is this one act, our sages assert, that merited Aaron the high priesthood. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 17, Jeroboam and Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Some years ago, Oxford University Press approached various writers, asking them to each select one of what is known as the seven deadly sins and write about it. Joseph Epstein chose to write on envy. When I was approached, he writes, pride, gluttony, and greed were already spoken for. I could therefore choose among anger, sloth, lust, and envy. End quote. Epstein tells us that he was drawn initially to sloth, a sin with which he had little experience, for he had always been, in his words, quote, of the Spielkes, or needle-in-pants school of personal psychology, end quote. In the end, however, he chose envy because, quote, I have felt more than enough envy in my life to qualify for writing about it, adding, to err may be human, but to envy is undoubtedly so, end quote. Envy of others can drive one to terrible deeds, and as rabbinic tradition understands it, envy lies at the heart of one of the great misdeeds in the history of Israelite kings, an assault on the people's connection to Jerusalem, and therefore a warning forever about Jerusalem's future. With the monarchy split between Jeroboam in the north and Rehoboam, son of Solomon, in the south, it would seem as if the former, Jeroboam, would be dominant. He rules 10 of the tribes of Israel and vast territory over both sides of the Jordan. But his kingdom does not have Jerusalem. And while he rules politically from his own territory, the temple remains the spiritual locus of all. It is incumbent on all of Israel to attend the temple celebration on Sukkot, Tabernacles. It is indeed incumbent upon the northern king himself to journey south and to honor God in a capital that is not his, a capital still loyal to the sons of David. It is this that Jeroboam finds so dismaying. The book of Kings tells us, and Jeroboam said in his heart, now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. If this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people shall turn again unto their Lord, unto Rehoboam king of Judah. And they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So the Bible tells us, and the sentence is stunning. Was Jeroboam, promised by prophecy that the northern kingdom would be his, truly worried about losing his life because of one holiday celebration in Jerusalem? Perhaps. But another reading of this story is that this was the rationalization that the northern king presented to himself for his actions that would follow. But what truly drove him was envy. Meaning, he could not tolerate that all of his subjects would go on the holiday to honor the king of Jerusalem, to honor the house of David. This is the larger meaning of a rabbinic story in which Jeroboam is told by God that if he reigns righteously, then ultimately he will be able to walk with God and King David in paradise. Jeroboam, the rabbis report, responded to God, "Who will go first?" Upon hearing that the son of Jesse, meaning David, would go first, the king of Israel turned down God's offer. Thus is the tragedy of Jeroboam's tale captured by Epstein's book. Envy, Epstein writes, quote, asks one question. What about me? Why does he or she have beauty, talent, wealth, power, the world's love, and other gifts, or at any rate a larger share of them than I? And he adds, that is the chief, perhaps only question for the envious, who have a deeper sense of injustice than others, end quote. Epstein further quotes Dorothy Sayers' insight that envy is what she calls the great leveler. The emotional assertion that no one should be more fortunate than oneself in any respect. They must be equal. Envy, Epstein further reports, is essentially a seeking of a form of leveling. And that, as he explains, is why we are not all that envious of people with whom we have nothing in common, whose fame and fortune we can never hope to enjoy. Epstein, like myself, is a Chicagoan, and he notes that, quote, one of the most popular people in the city of Chicago for many years was the Chicago Bears running back, the late Walter Payton. A very great athlete, he won all the emoluments to which his ability on the field entitled him. Fame, money, power. Epstein continues, my envying Walter Payton anything is absurd. I don't have the imagination to sustain such envy, and if I did envy Walter Payton, feeling that what he ought really to have been mine, I should have to be judged, rightly I think, insane. End quote. Human beings tend to be envious of their peers. And, as Epstein explains further, Because envy is about leveling, at its purest, quote, one doesn't even require any advantage for oneself, but is perfectly content to make sure that the next person derives no advantage, end quote. This point has been made by Jewish sages before Epstein wrote his book. The 19th century Rabbi Chaim of Brisk was once visited by the town butcher, who had found a hole in the lung of a prize ox that had cost 500 rubles. Rabbi Chaim told the butcher that the ox was not kosher, and the butcher accepted the decision without a murmur. Later, this is a story that I heard from my grandfather, the butcher came before Rabbi Chaim once again, this time as a litigant against someone else, arguing with a fellow Jew over a sum much smaller than 500 rubles. When again Rabbi Chaim ruled against the butcher exploded, calling Rabbi Chaim terrible names. Rabbi Chaim was then asked why, when his earlier decision had cost the butcher a larger sum, the butcher said not a word while he exploded over a smaller amount. The answer, Rabbi Chaim explained, was that the butcher did not really care about having the paltry sum of money in contention at the litigation. The butcher merely did not want his adversary to have it instead of him. This is the nature of envy. And just as most people might not be jealous of a talented running back, most people are not jealous of kings, but other kings certainly can be. Envy seeks leveling. And if the king of Judah had a house of worship for his subjects, then from Jeroboam's perspective, he needed his own house of worship, or perhaps two. Thus, did the drive to place himself on the level of the Davidic dynasty lead Jeroboam to committing one of the great crimes in Jewish history, the act of displacement of Jerusalem. The Bible goes on. Whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said unto them, it is too much of you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And he set the one up in Bethel and the other he put in Dan. And this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before one, even unto Dan. In the midst of Jeroboam's terrible crime, we also see cleverness. As we have seen in our earlier lectures, the site of one of Jeroboam's temples, Beth-El, a name that means house of God, seems to have been the site of Jacob's dream. It was known, in other words, for ancient Israel, as another portal to heaven, and Jeroboam seizes on its reputation in creating a rival to Jerusalem. But this, of course, was a terrible sin, not only because the temple involved golden calves, but also because once Jerusalem has been chosen, it and it alone must be the locus of Jewish worship. Envy drives Jeroboam to displace Jerusalem and to create golden calves, returning thereby to one of the first sins of Israel. Because all of the priests, the descendants of Aaron, ministered in David's city, in Solomon's temple, Jeroboam would also need other men to do the job in the temples in the north. We are thus further told, and he made a house of high places and made priests from the masses of the people, which were not of the sons of Levi. Meaning, the descendants of Aaron would not minister in the northern rivals to Jerusalem's temple. Non-Aaronites would perform the cultic rituals in the presence of the golden calves in Bethel and Dan. And we must understand the further terrible irony in this account. We know, of course, from the Bible that it was Aaron, Moses' brother, who facilitated the creation of the original golden calf. And the biblical reader might well wonder what this man did that was so extraordinary, that he, Aaron, merited to have the temple priesthood descend from him. The answer, our sages seem to suggest, can be found in God's statement at the beginning of Exodus, in instructing Moses to seek out his brother, to ask Aaron to serve as Moses' spokesman to Pharaoh. The Almighty tells Moses, behold, he, meaning Aaron, is coming toward you, and he sees you, and there is joy in his heart. It is this one act, our sages assert, the joyous greeting given to Moses by Aaron that merited Aaron the high priesthood. Aaron was informed that his baby brother had been chosen to become the most influential Israelite in the history of the people, and he responded with nothing but joy, with a fullness of heart, and without the slightest trace of envy. Only Aaron, our sages say, only Aaron, who was pure of heart, was worthy of wearing the bejeweled breastplate, the glory of the high priesthood, on his heart. The Talmud is telling us that had it been any other man, anyone other than Aaron who had received the news, he would not have reacted entirely with joy, but also, perhaps, with resentment. Epstein writes further that, quote, we have all felt flashes of envy, even if in varying intensities, from its minor pricks to its deep, soul-destroying, lacerating stabs. Epstein further writes that, quote, a word for envy exists in all known languages. And he adds, one is ready to believe it is the sin for which the best argument can be made that it is part of human nature, end quote. This is true, but not Aaron. There was only joy in his heart. And we are struck by how after an entire biblical book, meaning Genesis, replete from beginning to end with stories of havoc wreaked upon family life by envy between brothers, Aaron's attitude at the beginning of Exodus is stunning because we meet a man who does not define his success by the achievements of others, who does not begrudge Moses his fame, and who thereby merits a priesthood that is given to his descendants eternally. This moral excellence, this defiance of envy, stood as a merit for Aaron even in the face of the creation of the golden calf. And now, in the story of Jeroboam, we find how an act of envy, perhaps, helps lead to the creation of golden calves anew, which draw the people of Israel away from the temple in Jerusalem, away from the Ark of the Covenant, away from the sons of Aaron. It was the American Commodore Perry who, upon capturing British ships, said, "We have met the enemy and they are ours." This was famously inverted by the comic strip Pogo to, "We have met the enemy and they are us." We saw in our previous discussion how Pharaoh Shoshenq threatened Jerusalem but did not conquer it. Here, however, the first great challenge to the primacy of Jerusalem comes, and it comes from within Israel itself. The cutting off of 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel from Jerusalem for a generation. And we learn thereby from this story a warning which will present itself again and again. It is envy among Israelites that can threaten Jerusalem's well-being, and it is love, therefore, among members of God's covenantal people that will help preserve it and restore it. This, in the end, is the meaning of the conclusion of David's beautiful psalm celebrating Jerusalem. Leman achai v'rei'ai adabra na shalom bach. Leman beit Adonai Eloheinu avaksha tov lach. For the sake of my brothers, my covenantal brethren, I will speak peace unto you. For the sake of the house of the Lord, I will seek goodness for you. This is Meir Soloveitchik wishing all of you a Shana Tova, a new year of blessing, signing off.